KALW.
It's not just white, college-educated Republican women in the suburbs. It's also Latino voters who want these reforms.
Latinos are the fastest-growing group of independent voters.
The way we view the immigration issue has forever changed. There is no going back.
Today, how the priorities of a major voting bloc have shifted. Then, how a Supreme Court decision is impacting our unhoused communities.
City governments don't want to see visible unhoused people in public spaces anymore.
Plus, a Hollywood costume designer takes viewers from the 50s to the 90s.
I just fell in love with these characters and the story of friendship and love. And I just knew I had to do anything I could to get this job.
Telling stories through costume. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. When we think about major forces shaping the upcoming elections, the Latino vote is definitely one to consider. According to Pew Research, the number of Latinos eligible to vote grew from 27 million in 2016 to a projected 36 million people in this year's election. And the priorities of this demographic are changing, especially here in the Bay Area, where cost of living and housing are of high concern. And the Latino community is also the fastest growing group of no party preference voters. So what are the two major parties missing here? To understand where we are and how we got here, we held a live panel discussion at KALW's event space at 220 Montgomery, and we invited a group of experts following the Latino vote, including Mike Madrid, a co-founder of the Lincoln Project and author of The Latino Century. Here's an excerpt from that conversation where I asked Madrid if Kamala Harris's new immigration policies mark a new chapter in how we should think about the Latino voter.
This has been one of the most extraordinary presidential campaigns I've seen in my entire life and career. It's the first time in 30 years I'm not working on a presidential campaign or on a presidential effort. But to me, the most profound shift is the 180-degree turn that the Democratic nominee has taken on border security issues. I've never seen anything like it as fast as it has happened. It's politically the right thing to do. I hate the policy, but as a political professional, the pivot not only makes sense, it's the only chance she has at winning election. But let's be very sober and clear about what is happening here. Speaking to a group of 500 Latino students at Cal State Fullerton last night, Kamala Harris is running a campaign on immigration that is far to the right of what George W. Bush ran in 2000, a race that I did. Far, it's not even comparable. She's going to the border tomorrow to talk about building a wall. She's talking about thousands of new, her first ad that she was running was before she even took the stage in Atlanta, is to hire thousands of new border enforcement officers. She talks about prosecuting transnational gangs and drugs, which sounds eerily similar to drug dealers and rapists, and I guess some are very fine people. So, you know, she went before the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, on and on and on. I can tell you, the whole campaign is decidedly different. And I know that if this were a Republican, people would be lighting their hair on fire and marching up and down the street saying this is racism. And I believe that there is an appropriate role for a border security discussion in this country. But I also believe there's a lot of racists that talk about it in a very different way with a very different meaning. And I think Donald Trump is doing that. But we have to be very sober about what is happening here.
She's trying to come towards the middle and gain the people.
She's not in the middle. She supports the Lankford bill, a conservative Republican Senate, one of the most conservative Republican members of the United States Senate. They call it a bipartisan bill. There's nothing bipartisan about it. This was Lankford's bill, and the bipartisan piece was come on into the office and sign on the dotted line because we're getting everything that we want. And the Democrats said, absolutely, where do we sign? So it's not the middle. She's, again, to the right of every Republican nominee I've ever worked for or been affiliated with the exception, I didn't work for Donald Trump, I worked against him, but Donald Trump. So the nature of the way we view the immigration issue in the Democratic Party has forever changed. there is no going back. The issue of border security and immigration reform have now been decoupled. And this has been the strategy for three decades within the Democratic Party, is we're not going to put together a border security policy. We're not going to have any specifics, because if we do, we know the Republicans won't negotiate in good faith on the immigration reform piece, on the DACA piece, on the worker protections piece. And they're absolutely right. The Republicans were never going to operate in good faith. In fact, they didn't even negotiate in good faith on their own bill. They walked away from it after they got 100% of what they wanted out of the Lankford bill. My point is, we have moved 180 degrees away from where we were in January of this year, and 30 years, not 30, the entirety of Democratic politics prior to that on this issue. And you don't hear much more than a peep on this, because I think the desire to win is so intense amongst Democrats, for understandable reasons, that no one is saying a word about it. There's a little bit of clamoring and some chirping saying, well, we also, Latinos also want immigration reform. And that's true, but so do most other voters. And the other part, I think, which is fascinating, which has to be said, is that when Joe Biden signed the executive order on asylum restrictions, basically shutting down the border, 69% of Latinos supported that action, compared to 70% of all Americans. The difference between Latino voter opinion and the overall electorate is becoming minute. There's almost no difference. And Kamala Harris would not be doing this or going to the border unless she was getting a majority of Latino support on these issues. And that's tough medicine for a generation of Latinos who've been looking at our politics through the immigration lens.
So where do they go? What do they do? Who do they
go towards? They're voting for her. She's bringing them back. She has a ways to go. And I would look, Joe Biden, we were headed towards a disaster with Joe Biden. The Latino vote was splitting almost 50-50. Now, she's sitting at the high 30s, maybe low 40s, but she's brought 8, 9, 10 points back. She's not at the 2020 level where Joe Biden was at, which, by the way, was a historically bad position for a Democrat. He lost 8 points from Hillary Clinton, who lost 7 points from Barack Obama. This slide is not new. It has been happening for over a decade. And so when she doubles down on these issues, she's crashing into the polls that are saying it's not just Americans, it's not just white college-educated Republican women in the suburbs, although that's true, it's also increasingly Latino voters who want these reforms. Some of the biggest rightward shifts that happened in 2020 were along the border, not just in Texas, in southern New Mexico, in southern Arizona, in the Imperial Valley of California, the most Latino county in California, saw the biggest rightward shifts with Latino voters. This is a serious issue.
That was Mark Madrid, author of The Latino Century and co-founder of The Lincoln Project. And there's much more we talked about with more guests. We'll be airing a longer version of that panel and other KALW election events starting October 7th on the show Bay Made, right after Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. In June, the Supreme Court's decision on Grants Pass made it legal to remove homeless encampments. Since then, the Bay Area has felt the change. Following a statewide directive from Governor Newsom, San Francisco Mayor London Breed quickly ordered the removal of encampments. Across the Bay, Oakland Mayor Sheng Tao recently followed suit, issuing an executive order focused on clearing more encampments, including those sheltering in RVs. KALW News editor Sunni Khalid has been following all of this. He spoke to independent photojournalist Jessica Prado about Oakland's crackdown on homeless encampments. Jessica lives out of an RV in the East Bay and was recently arrested by police while documenting the sweeps. Here's Sunni.
What has been the effect of the Supreme Court decision and then Governor Newsom's order allowing local communities to go after homeless encampments? We get a lot of press. There's a lot of attention about what happened in San Francisco. But what has happened in the East Bay, specifically to RV communities of which you are a member?
Yeah, so basically in the East Bay, there's also a crackdown on, you know, unhoused people, whether you live in your vehicle or you live in a tent, you know, like basically city governments don't want to see visible unhoused people in public spaces anymore. So in terms of the RVs, well, the city of Berkeley has been towing vehicles that people live in, even though it's actually one of their policies not to tow them. Same thing with Oakland, you know, like it's also a policy not to tow shelter vehicles because you're degrading that person into like a worser situation. But the vehicles still continue to be towed.
You and I first spoke about 3.5 years ago. How can you compare the situation now when there wasn't the Supreme Court order, essentially the Supreme Court ruling giving local municipalities the power to do this? How does it 3 years ago compare to now?
Basically, 3 years ago, I mean, we had the Martin Business Voicing ruling. It actually gave local governments the responsibility to offer shelter to their unhoused residents, right, before clearing out any of the encampments. And I feel like because we had that ruling before, there was actually like a little bit more of like a stalling of clearing the encampments, right, because they actually have to come and help people. But now that that ruling has been basically overturned, you know, along with the Grants Pass ruling, it just basically has become a free-for-all, right? They just want to clear everybody out without offering shelter, you know? And there is like a lot of people that are needing these shelter beds. Like people are asking for shelter, which I kind of find really amusing that, you know, all these people do want to relocate to be in a safer place, yet city governments don't want to offer these services anymore.
Well, about a week ago, instead of as you were covering the news, you became the news. What happened and where was it?
So basically, I was reporting in Oakland, California. I was actually at the encampment on 23rd Street and Martin Luther King Way. And this is like a really big encampment where like a lot of, you know, African-American people that are disabled and are elderly, 65 and above, like a lot of the people that I interviewed were 65 and above. And I just found it amazing that basically the city of Oakland requested money from the state, like $7.5 million to help this specific encampment. Yet these people did not get the resources that they were promised or that they were used for in order to apply for these funds. And right now, like a lot of the residents had to relocate to nearby streets. Very few of them actually got, you know, shelter beds. Some of them got like a medical respite room for 14 days. So that's even like, you know, less time that you get to be inside. But yeah, basically a lot of the people were just like, you know, relocated.
So you were doing your reporting and then something happened.
Basically, I was just documenting people like taking their possessions with them because literally the only things that you can take with you is what you can carry with your hands. And I wanted to photograph what people are choosing to take, right? Or what are you like, you know, you're being rushed out. What are you taking with you?
So that these were the Department of Public Works and showed up?
Basically, all the residents and advocates, and there was another journalist on the scene too, they were all just basically trying to relocate the residents that were in that section of the camp and then just helping them like, you know, pack up their belongings. And that's basically what I was photographing, you know, people just trying to take their belongings. And I was standing in the sidewalk, you know, next to the porta potties, and the fences were actually open, you know, people were coming in and out. And then out of nowhere, just the police officers decided to just come towards me and told me to leave, you know, that I was violating the safe work ordinance, to what I was really confused about because, you know, there was literally everybody just going in and out. And they just specifically just came and targeted me. And then for me asking questions about why you're doing this, you know, that basically ended up escalating things to the point that, you know, they did not want to answer my questions and they just arrested me.
What happened? You were handcuffed?
There was like about like, you know, 5 to 6 police officers that surrounded me. And then they all started grabbing my stuff. Like, you know, one person was pulling my camera. Another one was pulling my fanny pack. Another one trying to unzip my backpack. And I was just like trying to save my camera. Says, like, don't take that away from me, right? You know, because this is my work. My footage is my work. And then like at one point, yeah, they took everything from me and then they handcuffed me. And they like, you know, they put the handcuffs really tight. And I was telling them, you know, can you loosen them up? You know, I'm not going anywhere. But yeah, you know, regardless, you know, the people that were around me took my stuff so that the police officers wouldn't take it. And then they just put me in the cop car, you know, for about 40 minutes until they decided just to give me a citation and release me.
Had that ever happened to you before?
Yes, it has. And actually, I got arrested in Berkeley in 2019 for just documenting somebody just getting their vehicle towed. And again, I was asking questions. It's like, why are you breaking into that vehicle when that person is not there? And the same thing, the police officer said that I was obstructing their work, which in fact, I was just standing in the sidewalk, and they just took me into the Berkeley jail as well.
Received a citation. Are you going to have to show up to court? Are you going to have to pay a fine? What happens from here?
They gave me a citation, and they actually gave me a trespassing charge, which is a misdemeanor. So this is like criminal charges that I'm facing now. And I'm actually working with the First Amendment Coalition and, you know, the Reporters for Committee for Freedom of the Press to like basically find me some kind of like an attorney that can help me, you know, deal with these charges, because they are bogus charges, you know. Like, actually, if you look at the Safe Work Ordinance, the work of a person that, like a press person, you know, your right is protected by the Constitution. And it even says that, you know, you are allowed to document. So in a way, this is a failure of their policy, right? Like, they're not actually following their policies to allow people from documenting.
Have you noticed a change since the point in time count? And even before this, did you notice a change in some of the tactics of the governments in the East Bay?
The point in time count, like, basically, it has become a little bit more precise in the East Bay, but I mean, it still needs work, you know? Like, you cannot just like count people one night and decide this is all the people that there is.
Jessica, what are the differences between the RV homeless community in San Francisco and those in the East Bay?
So right now, like, basically, the RV communities in San Francisco are facing, you know, a new kind of change in legislation, where basically London Breed is trying to change parking regulations to ban overnight parking of recreational vehicles all throughout San Francisco. So, you know, her tactic basically is to, like, you know, make people leave this area and not park here anymore. But similarly, in the East Bay, they also tried to do that, you know? Like, actually, Berkeley tried to do an RV ban in 2019. And basically, even unhoused people that live in their vehicles had to challenge this policy, and they actually won, you know? They actually got this ordinance off the books because the judge said that it was unconstitutional to actually enforce such policy. Basically, in Berkeley, it was like, people cannot park their vehicles between 2 in the morning to 5 in the morning. So, and they were like just banned from parking citywide in Berkeley. So basically, when residents challenged this ordinance in 2021, you know, they were able to have a settlement, and Berkeley had to take that off the books. So what I'm seeing now is that, you know, San Francisco's trying to do the same, you know, have an RV ban. But the question really is up in the air. Is this really a constitutional thing that you can do to people? Just prevent them from like sleeping and parking at night? But, you know, we'll find out.
That was award-winning photojournalist Jessica Prado speaking to KLW's Sunni Khalid. Jessica was recently arrested reporting on Oakland's crackdown on homeless encampments. Find all our reporting on homelessness at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Some people use a pen and paper to tell a story, but Whitney Ann Adams uses a needle and thread. Whitney is a costume designer who grew up in Moraga and got her start in the Bay Area theater scene. Now she's designing outfits for film and television productions, like the recently released movie The Supremes at Earl's All You Can Eat, where Whitney designed period-accurate costumes from across 4 decades of American history. She spoke with KLW's Janae Darden.
Whitney, welcome.
So nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
I cannot wait to talk to you because what you do is so interesting. What was it about costume design and costume fashion that drew you to this work?
I can really pinpoint sort of the moment I started to fall in love with costume design. And it was when I was 16 and I was really sick. I have a bunch of hereditary blood disorders and I was in and out of the hospital. And it was right when the movie Moulin Rouge came out on DVD. And I just started watching it every single day. And it took me on a world. It was an escape from my really painful present day life. And so with the costumes, the visual storytelling, all of that made me forget my troubles for 2 hours. And I just loved the power of costumes and how it could do that.
I could definitely see watching that movie why that would spark your interest. And you grew up in Moraga.
Mm-hmm.
How did the Bay Area shape your career? Like, were you involved in theater here?
I did theater all through growing up, elementary school, middle school, high school, Camp Lindo High School. And then I also took sewing classes. So my first sewing class was second grade at the Hacienda de las Flores Community Center in Moraga. So there's so many different places that started cultivating my love of the arts and my love of clothes and sewing.
Your latest project is the film, The Supremes at Earl's All You Can Eat. And you make outfits in just different eras from the 1950s to the 1990s. And the story set in the Midwest. What drew you to this film? Because I would just imagine just trying to cover so many eras.
It's a lot.
It was definitely a challenge. Yeah.
The logistics were quite challenging. I think I've always wanted to do a big period drama. It's something I've always wanted to do, especially my first movie was The Great Gatsby, getting to assist the legendary Catherine Martin, who also designed Moulin Rouge. So I learned a lot from her, but I always wanted to do my own. And so when this project popped up and I read the script and I just fell in love with these characters and the story of friendship and love and four different decades to play within, I just knew I was had to do anything I could to get this job.
Yeah, and it's an interesting story because about these three women, and it's quirky in a sense. Like, this, it's a quirky kind of dark comedy with some drama in it. So they're all, like, going through some really serious issues, and they're also looking back on their youth. So you're costuming, you're dressing people who, you're dressing the younger version of themselves, and then you're dressing the present version of themselves, but the present is in the 90s.
Right. A lot of layers. And I wanted to make sure that the older versions or the adult versions matched our, you know, youthful versions of these characters. But we were filming the younger 1968 section first. And so I wanted to make sure that I still had wiggle room to define these characters with my lead actors. So it was a lot of sort of working backwards and forwards to make sure every through line was connected.
And the characters are all Black. Was that even a factor, too, as far as, like, culturally, like, okay, what were Black, you know, teenage girls wearing back in the 60s? Or how are Black women dressing in the 90s?
Yeah, it comes down to the research, absolutely. And, you know, finding every real life photo that I could. Also making sure that my team was really diverse. About half my team was Black women. And so I was so happy to have them on board so they could fill in the cultural things that I will never understand being a white woman. So I had to sort of go at it from every angle, getting the research, reading about the different time periods, getting contemporary anecdotes, and just doing everything I could to tell this story as honestly as possible.
Do you actually sometimes have to make the clothes then too as well, I'm assuming? Like, if you can't.
Absolutely.
Like, maybe you see a pattern and you're like, okay, I see this pattern of this 1970s pair of pants, so let me make something similar to that and just sew something together.
Exactly. And if, you know, I had my wishes, I would have made everything for this movie, but we didn't have the time or money or labor. So you have to figure out how to cut corners. But there were quite a few specialty outfits that I ended up designing and having made in-house by our in-house tailor, who was incredible. And my favorite piece is this orange dress that young Odette wears, and it really establishes her style. And it's was made by her blind grandmother. And so I love the storytelling there. So we made the seams not really straight. We made the style of the dress a little bit more old-fashioned, but we also got this late 60s fabric that was bold and fiery, just like Odette. Mm-hmm. So I loved creating that because that dress didn't exist anywhere. And I wanted it to be very specific for the storytelling. So it was fun to create that.
I'm thinking of how the clothes tells a story, because you said that that orange and red and yellow, fiery, like her. So that reflected her personality. Mm-hmm. And she was the type of person who didn't care what people think or thought of her. And she put family and friends first. Mm-hmm. So I can see her wearing that dress. Like, yeah, it's not perfect, but it's for my grandmother. And it means something to me.
Exactly. Yeah. It means something to her. The thing about Odette is that she's the foundation. I mean, all of her color palette throughout the years are earth tones. They're bright, but they're also grounded. She's the foundational friend of this group and of the people in this town.
What is something that you want people to understand about a costume designer's job?
I think it's the biggest thing is it's so much more than shopping. I think a lot of people think, oh, costumes, they just go out and buy stuff and stick it on the actor. And you could sort of describe our job like that, but it's so much more. It's the storytelling. It's being a visual artist. It's being a therapist. It's being a psychologist. You have to break down who these characters are, why they wear what they wear. You have to, you know, be that historian who does all the research and figures out the time and place, no matter what the story is. It could be future, it could be past, it could be present, but you really have to dig into the history, the anthropology. So you really are wearing a lot of different hats. And that's not even to start talking about the logistical work of getting all the clothing pieces.
That was costume designer Whitney Ann Adams speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel. You can catch Adams' work on the show The Supremes at Earl's All You Can Eat. Today's Cross Currents team includes James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salyer, Shirin Adil, Henny Shaherjani, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.